News Centre at 5. The business secretary is being challenged by steelworkers whose jobs are at risk in Port Talbot. The government's accused of not doing enough to help the crisis-hit industry, as Tim Jones reports.
We're looking for an even playing field. That's what we're looking for.
Sajid Javid's met staff at Tata, which is selling its UK assets. He's accused of failing to tackle high costs and cheap steel imports.
Have we got an industry?
The industry is absolutely vital to the future of UK industrial sector.
But workers aren't convinced.
Until we see any action, they're just empty words. The time for talk is finished and the time for action is now.
The government's ruled out nationalisation, despite two in three people saying the plant should be taken into public ownership.
It's reported an inmate's been murdered at Coldingley Prison in Surrey. The Category C training prison in Woking holds 500 inmates. A teenager's been told he'll serve 9 years behind bars for stabbing a school pupil in Aberdeen. The 16-year-old denied murdering Bailey Gwynn but was convicted of culpable homicide last month. A delivery driver from Luton has been found guilty of preparing to carry out a terror attack on US military personnel in Britain. 25-year-old Junaid Khan planned to stage a car crash and attack someone with a knife. Commander Dean Hayden is from the Metropolitan Police.
He'd undertaken research and planning to actually make a pressure cooker bomb. And what we think is either before or during the actual attack on the US military personnel, if he'd been compromised in any way, he would have detonated that device and committed suicide.
There's a pay rise for millions of workers today as the new living wage becomes compulsory. Everyone over the age of 25 will now be entitled to £7.20 per hour, but unions say it's unfair as young workers are missing out. Hundreds of migrants and refugees have pulled down the razor wire fence surrounding a holding centre on the Greek island of Chios. It follows a night of clashes at the camp. And Denise Robertson, who was familiar to millions as this morning's agony aunt, has died aged 83. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
One love, one nation. Love BCFM.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's politics show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is former Cabinet Member and Green Councillor for Ashley Ward, Gus Hoyt. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here again too. After the 6 o'clock news, the Brussels attacks. Well, the EU doesn't have an official capital, but it's all based in Brussels pretty much, and NATO. So is this the United States of Europe's 9/11? Before we ask who really did it tonight, we go through the dozen or so major holes in the official story in the mainstream media account that they haven't asked questions about to explain what we're being told doesn't make sense. And we look forward to Thursday, the 23rd of June, and the EU referendum. But in the context of fraud, which is being revealed about last year's general election. We heard from journalist Simon Hines on this show about suspicious Tory swings in all the marginal constituencies, about disappearing ballot papers, and about postal vote fraud, which is now under investigation by former Tory minister Eric Pickles. The latest facts about last year's general election, an investigation conducted by Channel 4 News' Michael Crick, relate to the Conservative Party breaking electoral law by overspending and then presenting false accounts in Thornbury and Yate and a dozen or so marginal seats. To discuss the prospects of a free and fair EU referendum, we're joined by our Whitney correspondent, Dave Barmby. Plus, Martin's chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius, windy with some heavy showers. This weekend, highs of 14, sunnier on Saturday, outbreaks of heavy rain on Sunday. So don't do your shopping this week. Go out for a nice walk tomorrow. Next week, highs of 14 Celsius, wet and windy on Monday. The rest of the week, fairly sunny with occasional showers next weekend. 9th and 10th of April, highs of 11 Celsius, sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, In the run-up to Thursday, the 5th of May's local elections, we'll have two two-hour-long politics show hustings, one for the Bristol Mayor candidates next Friday here, that's on the 8th of April, and a fortnight after that, the Police and Crime Commissioner candidates on Friday, the 22nd of April. Any interesting questions to ask, please email them to me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk or via BCFM, studio@bcfmradio.com. So, helping us review this week's news, in fact the last fortnight's news, is former council cabinet member and Green councillor for Ashley Ward, Gus Hoyt. Hi Gus, welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi Tony, good to be here again.
Tell us, have you missed being in the cabinet? Do you feel like you haven't really been in the seat of power since you were, I think you were removed, weren't you?
No, I resigned.
You resigned, you had enough, had you? Yeah. Tell us about that incident, what happened?
Well, essentially, I was caught out on social media. Not actually on social media. I just had a private conversation with someone who was a friend, and it was all taken out of context.
Who you thought was a friend?
Who I thought was a friend, true, yeah. Yeah, stand corrected on that one. won't make that mistake again. But, yeah, essentially, it was all blown out of proportions. And, yeah, I just thought, you know, is this really the life that I want to be living, where, you know, every single part of your private life is under a microscope? And I just decided it was time for a break, and have enjoyed it ever since, actually.
So
it's quite nice.
You swapped around with who now is for the Greens on the cabinet?
Daniela Radici took over, and now it's a job share. So I think the first ever job share between her and Fee Hance.
But why have a job share? Because that means that no one quite knows who to talk to and who knows what about what. You can't have two people really doing the same job.
I think they're doing a really, really good job, actually. They've managed to split the portfolio up into two, and both being working mums, you know, I don't think they should be excluded from sitting at the top table. I think this is actually a very progressive move, and one that other cities should be emulating.
Okay, so what are you up to now? What committees are you on? And, you know, you're obviously not doing quite so much, not being in the cabinet, but what have you been up to recently?
Yeah, well, I'm still councillor for Ashley Ward, which is probably one of the busiest wards in the city. It's definitely the most diverse ward with the most people with the most needs.
Are you standing again next month?
Yes, next month, yeah, May the 5th, and for my third term. And I also sit on Destination Bristol and the Fire Authority as well.
Right, what's happening with the Fire Authority? Because aren't they thinking about merging? What's going on with them?
Yeah, there's all sorts of things going on at the moment. I can't remember what's confidential and what's not, so I'll probably
I mean, as far as I know, Wiltshire's merging with other Fire Authorities.
Fire Authority, yes, and we're also looking at...
But hang on a minute, you're there for us. What do you mean you don't know what's confidential? You're there to tell us what's going on, and you're saying, oh, it's confidential. Now, you're not working for a big board of a company, are you?
No, I'm not, but I'm also not their spokesperson either.
No, but so what's happening with the Fire Authority? I mean, that's what we get you in here to tell us. What's going on?
Okay, and what question exactly then?
Is Avon Fire and Rescue going to be merging with any nearby? Is there any prospect of them merging with nearby fire authorities? Because I know that for example, the Fire Brigade Union would be dead against that. Are there fire stations closing? That sort of thing.
No. There's been proposals that were brought to the table a couple of months ago, and all of us voted against that. But they are looking at relocating offices from outside of central Bristol. But they're literally looking at that at the moment. It's no definite move at the moment.
Yeah, I don't mean to be funny, but it's just like we rely on people like you who we elect to tell us what's going on, and we put you there to do that job, and yet you're saying to me, well, I'm not sure if I can tell you, it might be confidential.
Okay, well, I think I've just answered your question there. Sorry about
that.
So
is there anything you do want to tell us about what's going on in the Fire Authority? Because it's quite important, isn't it? I mean, it's one of those things over the years that the public has made sure is it very firmly in public hands, because in the past there was just ridiculous arrangements to do with private fire insurance, and the same is still the case in many parts of the world where only the people who've got the money can insure themselves against fire.
Yeah, we're certainly not heading down that route.
Okay. Also, in Ashley Ward, lots been going on, hasn't there, Gus, to do particularly with St Paul's Carnival and Malcolm X?
Yes. So Malcolm X Centre's still facing a bit of problems with the board. It's certainly not closing. There have been some rumours that Malcolm X Centre is closing. That is untrue, completely untrue.
I don't think that was what was the main topic for discussion. The main topic for discussion was the council... removing the previous committee that were managing it, and their argument was, well, why remove us? We've turned this place round.
No, it's actually a lot more complex than that one, and basically about a year and a half ago, the court process started to remove the then board, which then most people resigned and a new board stood up, but they didn't basically, you know, there was a
so the, this is council funded, is it, this court
yeah,
process?
Yeah, yeah,
our council taxpayers' money is going to fund a process to remove people from St Paul's?
Well, actually...
From the Mountain
Lake No. The council tax money is actually going to provide a community service run by and for the local community, and it does have to adhere to certain council policies, especially on equality and open access and things like that. And unfortunately, for a while, that wasn't happening.
So was it justified,
I do actually have full confidence in the current board, which is in about its third or fourth generation, and fingers crossed that, you know, they will be able to actually meet all the demands and keep the place
but
running.
But it did seem that it was a kind of an attempt to intervene to have who the mayor wanted to have run Malcolm X Centre rather than who local people wanted to run it.
No, it wasn't, not at all. It's always been run by a board. But the problem is getting people on the board that can actually represent the local people and actually their wishes. For example, a lot of time in its previous incarnation, not now, it was actually being run much more as a sort of nightclub rather than actually a community centre, obviously because those events brought in lots of money. But what people wanted it for is, you know, for the local people. So
I mean, can it be both?
It could be, but there's actually a very strong voice locally that they didn't want the nightclub, you know, open till 2-3 in the morning, and all the litter and associated noise and, you know, activities afterwards. So, you know, they actually wanted it as a much more conventional community centre. And I think the current board, in its current guise, is you know, on track for delivering that.
But can you see how having a former merchant venturer mayor intervening in the Afro-Caribbean centre, which was set up, you know, after the riots in the 1980s, is bound to be viewed as controversial?
Yeah, I'm not too sure how much George has actually been intervening on this one. If anything, he's actually been sort of coming in trying to keep
so
it
So who's
open.
Behind it then, you?
No, it's council policy, which has been
officers,
in place for...
Officers, council officers.
You know, if you want to actually blame someone like that, you could say it's
or legal, maybe legal.
But actually, it's the council policy, which is, you know, there to make sure that, you know, I hate using the expression, but, you know, taxpayers' money is actually spent properly and it's fully accountable for. So, you know, the council officers then, you know, follow the council policy, which, you know, has been around for, you know, 10, 20 years, and all other community centres have to abide
so
by the same rules.
So you're saying that the previous committee were misspending that money?
I don't want to go too far and say they're misspending because I haven't seen the books. But there was concern, I know, from the council's financial thing. And again, that was from the previous board, so not the current one.
Okay, so let's hope it all goes swimmingly. But obviously,
fingers crossed.
St Paul's Carnival isn't, is it? Why is that?
Yeah, this is another one of those ongoing issues, really, isn't it? Essentially, the carnival wasn't organised this year again, but something which has happened...
But it was stopped,
year,
wasn't it, effectively,
year,
by the police?
No, it was basically not organised again.
Well, the police said it wasn't. It didn't
The police certainly aren't fans of it going on in its current state, no. But the Arts Council England has met quite a few times with meetings with local stakeholders, with the Carnival Committee and with us as local councillors and the mayor. And they've actually, I think it's the only time actually that the Arts Council has actually held on to funds for a future, for the future carnival to happen. So normally if the money wasn't spent within its time frame, it would actually be taken away. But the Arts Council England is so determined to actually, you know, help Carnival be delivered that the funding's still there.
Well, I mean, doesn't it make sense? If they really wanted to help Carnival be delivered, surely what they could do is tweak the proposals that have been put forward at the end of last year for Carnival to happen this summer.
You can't just tweak something. I mean, basically, it's up to the Carnival Committee to
organise. Well, you can say only do this and don't do that,
you know,
and then we'll let you have a licence to have your carnival.
And that's, you know, they're certainly helping out in all the way. There's a couple of stakeholder meetings coming up in a couple of weeks, actually, in Docklands and St Paul's Learning Centre, I think. No, Malcolm X Centre, where local stakeholders will be discussing this.
And when you say stakeholders, you mean these open meetings for the community?
I got an invite from one of the people organising it, right. So I don't know how open these are, but there has been lots of them, yeah. I just,
I mean, it seems like a no-brainer, doesn't it, to have a carnival? I mean, it doesn't have to be
course,
enormous, and you know, there has to be some music.
And it's all very well. It's all very well just saying let's just have a carnival, but I mean, it's huge and it takes a huge amount of organising. If it's not organised properly, there's no recycling. There's you know, the safety aspects aren't there. The police have the city on lockdown. But organise well, everyone can go out and have a fantastic day.
And also, it's impossible to organise any event without trouble. There's bound to be trouble wherever, every single event. It just seems that we're in this kind of almost litigious culture where, I mean, we've had just today the announcement of the Youth Boxing Championships in Portsmouth being closed by the police, they say, because we can't guarantee that there won't be a death. Well, you could never guarantee there's not going to be a death in any event. You know, you can't guarantee. You could certainly insure against it, but you can't guarantee it, Gus.
No, you can't, and that's not why the carnival's been cancelled. You know, it's or not cancelled, like not gone ahead. It's basically, you know, as soon as they come up, you know, everyone comes up with a concise vision of what everyone wants the carnival to be, who they want it for, and most people actually say they want it for the family and for the people of St Paul's. You know, representing, you know, the history and where it all comes from. But in recent years, it's just turned into a massive rave on the streets, which goes on to the early hours. And actually, you know, there's loads of broken glass and all kinds of stuff in our local community parks for months to come. You know, I was finding shards of glass and still clearing them out of St Agnes Park.
But can you see why people say, well, actually, the council are just a bunch of killjoys. We just want to have a little bit of a party. And in fact, some of the people I've spoken to in St Paul's are saying, well, we are going to have a party.
And I'm sure lots of things will go ahead, yep.
Anyway, looking more towards some of the national stories from the last couple of weeks, Victorian-style paupers' funerals could return to Britain as families struggle to pay the costs of £2,000 for simple funeral ceremonies. State help for funerals has been capped at £700 for 16 years, which a Commons Work and Pension Select Committee said did not come close to the costs involved. Really, Martin, this is about the... benefits really not moving with the times, not increasing as the cost of funerals has increased. And there's in this article an example of a bereaved mother who was forced to actually put her son's body in a freezer for months while she saved up enough money for his funeral.
Well, there's always going to be some people who can't afford to have a funeral, and there's got to be some provision made for that, and clearly it's not adequate to the circumstances.
Gus?
Absolutely, yeah, I just completely agree with Martin. Now, I mean, you know, we mustn't just look after people in life, we've got to look after them in death as well. And, you know, the cost of funerals is going through the roof at the moment. And, we've got to make sure we look after each other.
The reason for this seems to be partly the inability or lack of wishes, Martin, for the Department for Work and Pensions to actually increase these amounts paid for people with no money to bury their loved ones in line with inflation.
Well, of course, it's the usual skinflint attitude. When we're bailing out the banks, money's no object, and that's still the fundamental facts that underlying everything that goes on in our country and many other countries around the world. And when it comes to vital provision like this for people who have can't afford
funerals.
Can I
also say, when it comes to...
We can't find the money.
When it comes to renewing Trident, also...
When it comes to bombing Libya, for example, you know, there's certain things where money doesn't come into it, and other things where it does.
Gus, 11 ways Ian Duncan Smith, because it's 2 weeks ago or so that he resigned.
He's finally resigned, yes.
We're looking at it. Made life harder for the most vulnerable people in Britain. This, I thought, was an excellent little summary. In the Independent, which, by the way, is still online, even if you can't get it in the shops. I think the Eye is still in the shops, but I'm not quite sure. I haven't had a look today. So here are the 11 ways Ian Duncan Smith made life harder for the most vulnerable people in Britain. One, he slashed the personal independence payment, which is funding to help disabled people live as independently as possible. So that went... risk forcing ill people to go to work because of faulty sickness assessments, that is the work capability assessment, kept saying that people were fit to work when they clearly weren't. He blocked information on benefit claimant deaths. The Department for Work and Pension refused to reveal how many people had been dying shortly after having their benefits cut. He increased sanctions for people on sickness benefit, abruptly stopping benefits. That amount increased hugely. Figures suggested sanctions increased fourfold, prompting Homelessness Charity Crisis to warn they were cruel and leave people utterly destitute. He also capped the Access to Work scheme, a scheme which was designed to help severely disabled people into work. He scrapped the Independent Living Fund, established in 1988, to help people with disabilities live independent lives. And he spent £8.45 million on a mascot. Alongside austerity cuts, Ian Duncan Smith provoked ire when it was revealed that a cuddly mascot called Worky was commissioned for the Department for Work and Pensions to promote pension changes, and it cost £8.45 million just for this mascot to be designed. Then also he introduced something called the bedroom tax, which I think many people have heard about. He invented fake benefit claimants to praise the Department for Work and Pensions. So last August it was revealed the Department for Work and Pensions invented fake benefit claimants for their leaflets, which they said were really pleased with their benefits had been cut. Of course, I imagine it wasn't easy to find people who would say, thank you for cutting my benefits and thank you for making me starving, destitute and getting me evicted. I argued that 0 hours contracts aren't that bad, just need a new name. So he said it's badly named, the 0 hours contract. And finally, number 11, he tried to suppress memos on universal credit. Martin, I don't think there'll be a lot of people sad to see him go, Ian Duncan Smith.
Well, he's got his supporters in some parts of the country. What's really bizarre about this is that he's finally, I think the political significance is he finally came out with it and said, well, actually, this is unfair. We're hitting disabled people at the same time as cutting taxes for the wealthiest, and that's not one nation conservatism. And I think the political importance of that is it means that we've hopefully reach the bottom now of this kind of attack on the poorest in the society. I'm not saying that the attacks won't continue, they will, but it's going to be very difficult for Cameron and Osborne to salvage their austerity policy from this attack by Duncan Smith. So in some respects the most useful thing he's done is resigning.
Yeah, I mean, Ian Duncan Smith was just a classic example of this government's kind of philosophy that almost the Dickensian age was the golden age of Britain, and they've been sort of trying to drive us back to this age. Your opening story was about the Victorian paupers' graves. It also seems to me as if they're trying to bring back the workhouse, really, and all the time this huge propaganda machine just telling us that, you know, it's for the good of us all. Personally, here in Bristol, I was in charge of housing for a while when he introduced the bedroom tax, and he didn't even consult with local authorities on how that would play out, and just, you know, gave blanket rules for all local authorities to comply with. Luckily, here in Bristol, you know, we managed to do what we could, and no one was actually turfed out. But in many cities, people were made homeless by this. Also the same with people with disabilities or just unable to work. Huge amount of hardships being felt. And I don't think his resignation came too soon. I kind of agree with Martin that, you know, hopefully, you know, we'll be able to start clawing it back now. But I think it's sort of too little too late. And I think all the main attacks have already happened.
Well, One of the main problems with the reversal of the cuts to disability benefits that this is all part of just after the budget is this: it's left a £4.4 billion hole in that budget, and that was what was brought up last week in Prime Minister's questions by the Leader of the Opposition, Jeremy Corbyn.
If I could invite the Prime Minister to leave the theatre and return to reality. The reality is that he has presided over a budget that unravelled in 2 days and now contains a £4.4 billion black hole in it. He may wish to consult the Chancellor on yet another change of heart on this matter. Could he now consult the Chancellor and tell the country who's going to pay for this black hole? Is it going to be cuts or tax rises? Where will the cuts fall? Where will the tax rises take place? £4.4 billion has to be found from somewhere.
Oh, suddenly the king of fiscal rectitude speaks. He may have
have noticed the budget passed last night, and it's a budget that cuts the deficit in every year of this Parliament. It's a budget that delivers a surplus by the end of this Parliament, and none of that is going to change. He talks about this budget. I'll tell him, look, hold on. The hostile, you shout, hostile shout, that's right. But neutral but not hostile. You have to be quiet, I think. Oh. Hold on. No. I want to know. Hands up who's Core Support Plus. Anyone else? I'll tell you what this budget did. It took 1 million people out of income tax. It saw more money for our schools. It helped the poorest people in our country to save. It cut taxes for small businesses. It cut taxes for the self-employed. It made our economy stronger. It made our country fairer. And it's a budget that will help this country do better.
Well, this is the usual knockabout of Prime Minister's questions. I mean, the new Prime Minister's questions when Jeremy Corbyn first started has clearly gone the way of all flesh. I think Cameron's point that why do we have to find this $4.4 billion is apposite, because there's no particular reason why we have to get the budget down to the deficit down by 2020 into balance. And
Hang on, because we heard 2 weeks ago from Richard Murphy, there's no chance of that.
Well, there is no chance of that. So in a sense, that's right. But of course, what Corbyn could be saying is, well, actually, there isn't a real problem here because we don't actually have to get the deficit down in the timescale that you suggested. And I think that is going to become increasingly clear. They're not going to get the deficit down in the timescale that's been suggested because they won't be able to. Things like crashing steel industries and banking collapses and so on are going to get in the way of it. And what will happen before the next election is that the deficit will probably go up as a result of all these things that we're, you know, these holes in the road that we're going to fall down. It's not necessarily the end of the world. I think we've got to, you know, we've had this narrative that we've got to get the deficit down. Yes, in the long run you have to kind of manage it, but the idea that you've got to do it all in one go was always idiotic, and that's why they're not going to achieve the target they've set themselves, because it's unachievable.
Gus?
Yeah, and just to add to that, I mean, it's not just, you know, this the crashing steel industry. That's kind of like the icing on the cake. You know, if we're going to actually tackle the major issues facing us, you know, that of climate change, then it's going to take just vast investment at the moment. And
what's your view about Hinkley? Because that was being put forward as one of the major things which was going to actually supply energy, but that wasn't going to contribute to climate change.
No, that's a complete white elephant and a huge waste of money. They're just pouring money down the hole at the moment. They're over at Hinkley. Nuclear is certainly not the way forwards. England could actually be leading the way on tidal and offshore wind at the moment. And instead of doing that, we're investing vast amounts of money in nuclear in an industry which, you know, other countries are actually who are far more advanced than us, who are, you know, they're giving up on it.
Well, it's not us, it's the Chinese that looks like are going to be investing.
Well, they're the ones that will profit the most.
I wonder whether there is a certain... possibly whether the money that's coming for Hinkley from China supposedly has influenced the British government's decision to intervene in the European Union to stop the EU putting up trade barriers to the steel, which we're being told is being dumped. So let's move on to the talking about Paul Talbot, because I was looking yesterday online. The Daily Telegraph was saying there's going to be 1,000 jobs go. The Mirror and the IPPR were saying actually it's much more like 50,000 or 40,000 jobs because of the knock-on effects in other parts of Tata and also in the local areas where these steel plants are. People just aren't going to have the money to spend and businesses are going to collapse.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, you look at Detroit when the car industry moved down to Mexico from there. You know, it wasn't just the people working in the factories that lost their jobs. It was, you know, all the other services around there, the cafes, the shops, everything else. You know, the entire city collapsed. And, you know, it's is the first city in America to actually declare bankruptcy.
But, I mean, the government will say, well, actually, we can't really intervene under EU competition rules. If governments intervene, they can be taken to court in situations like Port Talbot.
Yeah, but then you go to other countries in the
EU. They get around the law.
Well, no, you find out they actually just stick up for the people, and the EU is all about our own interests. And you know, if you're sticking up for a whole town, a whole city of people, you know, I think you'll find that the EU would actually bend their rules, and you'll actually find there's ways around that. I think that's an excuse given by the current government.
Well, why do they want to see, if that's what you're implying, Port Talbot go down?
It's the whole free market economy, isn't it? I mean, you know, why are they still banging that drum? You know, it's driving the whole world, the whole world's economic system into extinction. This is just, you know, yet another example of that. It doesn't work. It's neoliberalism. Like, why are we still trying this failed experiment?
Martin, we keep hearing about steel being dumped on world markets by the Chinese, and the Chinese complaining the EU are trying to do the same. Actually, really, this is about a collapse in demand, isn't it?
Well, it's a number of things. It's a collapse in demand in the world economy, that's true.
In steel, particularly.
You've got overproduction of steel everywhere, because what happens, of course, is a steel industry, the logical reason for putting into public ownership, and of course it was publicly owned as British Steel at one stage, is it's a cyclical industry. So when the economy's expanding, especially if you've got a manufacturing economy like we used to have in Britain, and they've still got in places like Norway and Germany, you need a steel industry as a central component.
Well, what you're saying is we don't need it then.
Well, the point is we've moved away from being a manufacturing economy because we haven't had an industrial strategy.
So what are we?
Well, we're supposedly a service economy, largely, but of course services are not internationally tradable by and large, which is why we've got a massive trade deficit. Even though the economy is just spluttering, we've got a huge trade deficit, and that's because we don't make things anymore and we don't sell them into the international market. Now, you can't wave a magic wand and change that. It's a whole philosophy that goes back 30 years to the Thatcher era and so on. But as I was saying earlier, British Steel used to be owned by the public sector, and the reason for having steel industries in the public sector is because they are subject to cyclical pressures. So when the economy is going down, they don't make money. When the economy is going up, they do.
But isn't
so,
this?
They need to be able to keep them going in the downturn, so they'll be there for the upturn.
Almost the whole of the public sector, many many things in the public sector, are now outsourced, and then they've slowly collapsed over the years. The same thing happened with our industries. I mean, if you go back to 1973 when we entered the EEC, actually we only had a vote, didn't we, 2 years after that as to whether to stay in or not. Those industries that used to be publicly owned, used to be very successful, have slowly gone, haven't they?
Well, I don't think it was entering the EEC. The real turning point was Thatcherism.
Well, privatisation.
Yeah, well, privatisation came in with Thatcherism in 1979. The real problem underlying all of this is, you know, you've slightly discommoded me there because you've changed the subject
matter.
Well,
hang on, because what we're trying to do here is analyse what's going on with the steel industry. It's not just that it was privatised, it's also that it's become part of a much bigger...
You've reminded me, the Tata brothers, when they took over British Steel, they borrowed a lot of money to do it, like these people who buy football clubs. And now, of course, they can't pay. And so if it had been publicly owned, the profits that British Steel would have been previously would be there to subsidise the loss-making phase of British Steel.
It's fascinating me because I start to
think, of course, we can't do that.
Who are the shareholders, right? Is it hedge funds? Is it banks? And I can remember, I mean, I've been reading, you know, the Martin Bormann Nazi in Exile book, rereading that again, and it was quite clear from there. He was looking at the German steel cartels and other cartels in Germany, and what they were doing was they were basically buying up, you know, before they invaded countries in World War II, they were buying up bank shares, and the banks had big stock holdings in industry. And so when they invaded a country during World War II, France, for example, they say, well, leave that steel plant alone, because they're actually ours and we have the majority shareholding. I haven't heard, Gus, I don't know if you have, who actually is the biggest shareholder in Tata, because they are the people, surely, who are making these decisions, the shareholders, not the owners.
Yeah. I'm sure they are. So I was just getting carried away with your apocalyptic sort of fantasizing, and I thought you were going to end up that we were at the beginning of World War III there. So.
Well, we may be.
We may be, yes. All I'm saying is, I suppose, that these big industries, often the actual ownership of it, who is deciding who's on the board, etc., who's making the decisions, the shareholders are quite you know, lost in a lot of the discussions. So,
well, the Tata brothers borrowed a lot of money to
so
buy British
almost certainly
Steel.
Be the banks.
And they have then they can't pay that money back. It's the same thing's happened to Man United and to and when you buy things on a leverage buyout like that, as soon as you hit the bumps, then you've got to pay the money back and you can't pay it and you liquidate. Now, in actual fact, if the steel industry had remained in public ownership, the profits from the years of profit would be there to be reinvested during the times of loss, and that's why steel industries tended to be in the public sector when we had a more sane economic policy in Europe and in Britain. But that's gone the way of all flesh a long
time ago. But Martin, do we actually really need a steel industry if it can't compete?
Ultimately, if you've got to make a decision about whether you want to be in manufacturing or not,
so
we may be past the stage now where Britain can actually fantasise about being a manufacturing nation, and there's no easy
so
way to
just import
steel save the steel.
It's okay to just import cheap Chinese steel, is it?
Well, what the other problem is, as you pointed out earlier, the EU were willing to put fairly stiff tariffs on Chinese steel. The Americans have got a 226% tariff on steel coming in from China into their market, and the EU has got a much lower tariff, and most of the European countries wanted to raise that tariff, and Sajid Javid blocked it, and so did the government, because they want to keep in
to be
with
fair,
the Chinese, as you suggested, about
to be fair, it's not just the British that have blocked it, and this is part of the problem with the EU, Gus, maybe, that you know, it's almost impossible to get all these governments to agree on anything.
Well, yeah, you never get all the governments to agree on everything, but just going back to your point there about privatisation, I mean, essentially, when all these services or industries are privatised instead of run by the nation, then they're no longer run for the nation. You know, that they're run for the shareholders, and basically for the bottom line, for the maximum amount of dollar. And if that's if that comes by selling it off or liquidating a company or a service, that's what they'll do, or providing less services. Whether you're talking about the steel industry or the local bus company, you know, privatisation follows the same rules, and I think it's greatly let down this country in the last 30 years.
Another point which was made last week in Prime Minister's Questions before this Tata Steel news hit the beginning of this week was made by, I think he's Neil Kinnock's son, and he's the local MP down in Port Talbot.
Stephen Kinnock.
Speaker, I trust the Prime Minister will be aware that there's a critical meeting of the board of Tata in Mumbai on Tuesday. I'll be flying out to Mumbai with the General Secretary of Community Union to make the case for British Steel. That meeting will be deciding on the future of the Port Talbot Steelworks in my constituency. Will the Prime Minister join me in exhorting Tata to stand with that plan and to secure the future of the Port Talbot Steelworks? Yeah.
I absolutely give him my backing on that. A team of ministers met yesterday to discuss all of the things that we can do to get behind the steel industry at this vital time. It's an extremely difficult market situation with the massive global overcapacity and the huge fall in steel prices. But the areas where we've taken action already, and we'll continue to look at what more we can do, and that is state aid compensation so we can secure the energy costs, greater flexibility over EU emissions regulations. We've done a huge amount in terms of public procurement, which I think can make a big difference to our steel industries. All of those things and more, and making sure that Tata and others understand how valuable we believe this industry is to the UK, and there's a government that within the limits that we have wants to be very supportive and very helpful.
Yes, well, we'll see if they are. It certainly doesn't seem to be much going on. Martin, the business secretary, Sajid Javid, has come back from Australia, and a lot of commentators saying, well, he wasn't really prepared for this. Well, he should have been, because there it was in the House of Commons at Prime Minister's Questions being discussed a week and a half ago.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the sort of political gossip around the actual timing of the announcement and so on. There has not been an industrial strategy in Britain for years. The Tories don't believe in an industrial strategy. They believe that the market will decide. And Britain, of course, has allowed most of its industries to be sold off to foreign business interests like the Tata brothers, who borrowed the money to buy it, as I was suggesting earlier. And then, of course, things like this come along and they're completely lost. And, of course, it's a symptom of the fact fact there's overproduction in steel because there's overproduction of everything else, well, there's going to be a further crash. We bailed the banks out last time.
It seems all the discussion is about the supply side. Oh dear, the price has gone down, we've got too much, but no discussion about the causes of this, which is just a complete collapse, it seems, in the real economy, even though the casino economy is doing very nicely, which is where we get all these figures about GDP from.
Real economy. It's a signal that we are moving into a deflationary spiral. That's what it is. And there will be a deflationary spiral. Things are going to get an awful lot worse because the world economy is shot to pieces because of quantitative easing and financial jiggery-pokery.
Okay, back to some local stories. And three mayoral candidates give their election pledges. This is in the Bristol Post. Tory candidate Charles Lucas is promising to ramp up cycle safety training. George Ferguson's election pledge, he says no new RPZs in Bristol areas where most people don't want them. And Lib Dem candidate Kay Barnard's published her manifesto, which plans radically help improve Bristol's environment. In fact, plans to, I think, radically help improve Bristol's environment, including setting ambitious recycling and waste targets. Gus, what do you make of these candidates, and what's your Green candidate saying?
Well, I believe the manifesto, rather than just a pledge, is coming out very shortly from Tony Dyer, our candidate. But as far as these three pledges go from the Conservatives, George Ferguson, the Independent, and the Lib Dem candidate, they're all pretty safe. They're all pretty safe pledges. I don't think anyone really disagree with any of them. I'm a cyclist myself.
I'll even agree with the
Conservative one saying that we need cycle safety.
With George on the
training.
RPZs, is that an admission that he's kind of overstretched himself a bit and he's lost?
No, I think he's just he's sick and tired of taking a kick in over RPZs, to be honest. And where I represent in Ashley Ward, we're actually holding a lot of public meetings, or we just finished holding a lot of public meetings, asking people in St Werburgh and St Andrews, you know, do you actually want an RPZ? Because we're receiving hundreds of emails from local residents saying, you know, we desperately need one. Like, you know, our roads are just, you know, chocking up with cars. This is also, of course, because they've come in elsewhere. But it's,
I mean, has it been a success in Ashley, do you think?
Yeah, Montpellier, where I live, it's lovely. I mean, I can walk, I can cycle, and Anna can drive, and that might come as a shock to you, but I do drive as well.
Have you got a car? You haven't got a car, surely.
It's my partner's car, but yes. But no, I mean, it's, you know, you can see around corners, people aren't parking up on the pavements anymore. It's a huge improvement.
And that's your view?
That's my personal view.
What do you think most people in St Paul's would say?
And St Paul's and Montpellier were the two areas in Ashley where it's come in. You've obviously got some people who still hate it. But even on people on, I believe it's, is it Morgan Street, where they had the protest, and it's the one street that hasn't got the RPZ come in. About half the people apparently have now applied for permits because they actually want to park elsewhere. You know, people have actually realised that it's not a huge price to pay. Rob and I both argue that there should be a sliding scale. So those on a low income should actually be receiving their permits for free, and those people on a high income, you know, making up the difference. But unfortunately, then the then assistant mayor said that wasn't possible. But yeah, generally, I'd say that once a zone comes in, most people see a benefit.
I mean,
quite
how
happy.
Much is it, the annual fee for a?
It's 47 quid.
Mm. I suppose if you spread that over the year,
it's less than a pound a week.
Yeah, but you see, I bet you what's going to happen is when they're looking at the budget in the future and they pull away the rate support grant, they'll say, oh, we'll have to double or quadruple the amount people pay for their parking permits.
I would never try and guess what any future mayor is going to do.
I mean,
in this
I know
city.
You're quite concerned about congestion, aren't you, in the city and pollution,
yeah,
particularly.
Pollution creates, yeah.
And what you know, I noticed you're talking about recently about taxing people with diesel cars.
I'm not sure if that was me talking about that. I'm
no?
a bit.
Isn't it something to do with a sort of having an anti-pollution zone or something?
A low emission zone. So,
what does that mean?
Oxford. Basically, it's any vehicle that's you know, high polluters is you can't go in the city centre. They've got them in Oxford. They've got them in London. Got them in many cities all around Europe.
So you have to sort of swap your diesel car for a petrol car.
And yeah, what the main difference though is not that many people still have diesel cars. The main polluters there are actually the delivery trucks and also the buses. So you're actually forcing then the delivery companies and the bus firms to invest in much cleaner technology.
Okay, but it's another tax, isn't it? It's, you know, no, it's not a tax. It is. I mean, it would be if someone's got not a decent car.
No, it's not a tax in the slightest. I mean,
like I have.
Tackling air pollution, which kills, I forget how many people here in Bristol every year, and causes endless amounts of asthma and other breathing-related issues, also breathing in all the particulates. If you're tackling that, and these tend to be in the poorer neighbourhoods where the other people are driving through, along the M32 corridor and areas like that. So it's other people polluting our neighbourhoods, the health costs alone.
It's got to be a carrot or stick approach. This is the stick approach, isn't it? Why not just provide decent public transport cheaper public transport so that people don't need to use their cars?
That would be the golden answer, wouldn't it? And if we didn't have the public transport that was no longer public but privatised, then I think we'd stand
Sort out the congestion problems in the city rather than tax people because there's so many cars everywhere?
Well, I think that very radical solutions which suggest themselves to me, such as having free public transport, is an obvious, if you're going to do something, you might as well go the whole hog and do it. But of course that runs against the philosophy that everything's got to pay its way. I mean, in actual fact, public transport systems in cities don't pay their way. Nobody can make them viable as private enterprises, which is, you end up subsidising private enterprises to pretend that they're making a profit. But if you get rid of that idea, you could probably radically change things, but you wouldn't be allowed to do it. What happened with the fares fare policy in the 1980s in London when Ken Livingstone tried to reduce the fares on public transport and subsidise it through the business rate? It was declared illegal by the House of Lords. And so even though he'd been elected on that as his manifesto, it was declared illegal and it was kicked into touch, even though nobody anywhere in the world manages to run big cities like London with their transport system at a profit.
Even though in the first year of fares fare there was something like 1,500 less serious accidents on the roads.
Indeed. But you can see those were the missed opportunities of 30 years ago. And we've just carried on marching firmly in the wrong direction for 30 years. No wonder we haven't resolved anything.
And in the meantime, of course, all the city development has been built up around to favour the car public transport rather than public transport.
The infrastructure
hasn't been going in. Government grants have all been for new roads rather than rail or bus infrastructure.
The new mayor... If he is a new mayor, maybe it will be George again. Maybe it will be Lord Ferguson again. Who knows? Must tackle Bristol's institutional racism, say the churches in a pre-election manifesto, laying out how the mayor could work with churches and other voluntary groups to make a fairer and more just city. Collaborators Churches Together and the Bristol District Evangelical Alliance said there were still parts of Bristol where black and ethnic people are simply not welcome. Is that your experience, Gus?
Yes, it is. I mean, I represent St Paul's, and I think over the last 5 years that I've been a councillor there, I've witnessed firsthand people held back because of the colour of their skin. I think this is something which is very timely to come.
But that's not what they're actually saying there, is it? I mean, they're saying parts of the city where they're not black and ethnic minority people are not welcome.
Well, yeah, that's being held back, isn't it? If you're not welcome somewhere, I'm sorry, but not quite sure.
Maybe it's a smile to your face and a knife in the back, eh? Yeah, so, I mean, basically double standards. People who are saying, well, yes, we do welcome people, but then actually when it comes to it, they're discriminating against them.
Yeah, and institutional racism is very dangerous because very often the people involved don't realise they're actually committing it either.
Martin, this is quite interesting to see the churches intervening like this. Collaborators almost makes them sound like some sort of terrorists. But anyway, it's a weird word for the Bristol Post to use. I mean, surely the bigger, much bigger problem is the wealth divide. I mean, if we're talking about equalities, that's the thing that's really the biggest gap that's opened up from a moral point of view over the last, 5-6 years, is one between people who just don't have access for whatever reason because they have literally no money or are living in desperate housing.
Well, that's true, but black and minority ethnic people are overwhelmingly overrepresented in those disadvantaged groups. And, people who say that there is no such thing as racism clearly, you know, it's still there. It's going to take a long time to eradicate it. And as has just been pointed out, often people who are institutional racists don't even realise that they are. What tends to happen, for example, when jobs are going in the council or in other organisations, people tend to recruit people like themselves, people they think will fit the you know, they're not consciously excluding black and minority ethnic people. It's just that those people don't necessarily have, you know, they don't fit the job description that people have in their minds of the people who are giving the jobs away. And there's also outright racism. It still exists. It hasn't gone away. There are some people who really are racist. They're out there, and they still have those attitudes.
Do you think, Gus, that the widening gap between rich and poor gets missed sometimes in this whole equality agenda? Because everyone's talking about equality, but we're missing this, you know, the sort of St. Paul's Clifton divide, which is getting bigger and bigger all the time.
And the divide within St. Paul's itself, you know, you've got a large part which is near the very city centre, which is very affluent and tends to be more white, and then the traditional areas of St. Paul's itself.
One thing you will be pleased about is the Bristol Arena transport plans. I would hope so anyway, Gus, have been revealed. Revised plans for the arena include a shuttle service from Bristol Parkway and more bike spaces. Plans to tackle transport concerns for Bristol's £92.5 million arena have been revealed. A decision on the 12,000 capacity venue was deferred by councillors because of concerns about how people would get to and from it. What are your thoughts about the arena, and do you think that this is, it's all now on the starting block ready to go?
Well, pretty much everyone I've spoken to wants the Bristol Arena. You know, I think that's the kind of starter for 10, which everyone agrees on, or most people agree on. The thing is, you know, how is it going to affect the local communities? And that's what most people are concerned about. So, you know, are people going to be driving from all over the southwest and parking all over Windmill Hill or elsewhere in the city centre? And the simplistic argument was, you know, you have to provide more car parking spaces to make sure that they don't park in the community areas. Whereas I know a lot of local campaigners are trying to get a form of residence parking actually introduced in the communities surrounding, you know, within walking distance of the arena, and provide more sustainable transport. So, you know, I know that it's always been a vision that most people arrive by train or by coach, but then we need to have ample spaces for those coaches to park, and also for them to wait while the shows are on.
Is it right when we've got we need housing as well? Is this the right priority, the arena, and are we going to be saddled with debt for years to come as a result?
No, the books I've seen, and they were, you know, admittedly a couple of years ago, it will pay for itself and generate a huge amount of income for the city itself. Whether you can say, you know, should we be spending that money on housing instead? Personally, yes, I'd put that into housing, but that wasn't on the table with the deal.
Martin?
Well, yeah, I think that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, we talk about we're having a mayoral election for who's going to run Bristol, but in actual fact, most of what you can and can't do is set by central government, who won't let you. I mean, everybody, including the Tory chap who was on here the other week, is in favour of a big push on social housing, council housing in Bristol, but it doesn't matter who we elect, the central government will make it very difficult for any mayor to carry out that promise. And there's an element of make-believe about all of this, because more and more power is actually in the hands of central government.
OK, back to last week's Prime Minister's questions now, and a question on education.
Suella Fernandez!
Yeah. My right honourable friend will have seen the recent OECD report on literacy and numeracy in England. Based on data from 2012, it ranks our teenagers as bottom out of 23 developed countries for basic maths and reading. A damning indictment of 13 years of Labour's education policy. Doesn't this show...
Order! 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 The Honourable Lady is entitled to ask a question. And the same goes for every other member. Suella Fernandez.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Doesn't this show why a more rigorous curriculum and more autonomy for schools to succeed are vital to turn around the life chances of the next generation?
My honourable friend.
Caroline makes an important point, which it is worthwhile benchmarking your education system against other advanced countries. And what we've seen in recent years is the competition is very tough. But when you look at the countries that are succeeding, whether it is Republic of Korea or Finland, they have well-paid teachers, they have proper accountability systems for results, they have rigour in terms of their discipline, and that is exactly what we're introducing in our country with the new curriculum coming in right now.
Well, it's interesting that you should mention Finland.
I mention Finland quite frequently.
Finland, in fact, is the only European country in the top five of these, they give supposedly independent studies of basic skills. And Finland is in the top five. The other four are all in Southeast Asia. Now, the thing about the Finnish education system is that they abolished private schools a generation ago. They're all fully comprehensive, their schools. They have no testing at all, none at all, until children are 18. And they do a big exam when they're 18, and then they're all sent off to do it to their various, the exam decides where they all end up. And in other words, they have a fantastic comprehensive system with no testing at all until 18. And what they are proposing to do in Britain is to turn the clock back to what we had in the 19th century, payment by results and all the rest of it. It's a grad grind approach to education, completely the opposite of what they do in Finland. In Finland, for example, like in all Scandinavian countries, nobody is taught to read or write before the age of 7, because they all go to nursery school when they are 3, and they learn through play for 4 solid years before they're introduced to reading and writing. At age 18, their kids outcompete our kids. Now, why would that be? It's because they know what they're doing about education.
But Martin,
and the Tory government,
the whole question
doesn't.
The question was about the seeds for the Britain being at the bottom of the 23 OECD countries for education is something which was a path was laid for that by the Labour government.
What the Labour government did in the 13 years they were in power was to continue with the testing and national curriculum and academy policies of the previous Tory regime. Because, of course, Tony Blair was head boy at Fetters. He went to private school in Scotland. He went to the Scottish version of Eton. You've got people like Tristram Hunt now, who's a Labour education spokesman. Again, a privately educated person. If there's a note of bitterness in my voice, it's because all my family are state school teachers, and they have seen the wreck of the system that they used to believe in. And of course, what they believed in was a Finnish-style system. But of course, we're doing testing. I'm working in an academy school at the minute, and we were testing the six-year-olds the other day on stuff we hadn't even taught them yet. And not surprisingly, they couldn't do it because we hadn't taught it them yet. What's the point of testing them? You may well ask. But it's got nothing to do with Finland at all.
Well,
in fact, Finland is a very interesting example of how you do it right, and it's completely the opposite of what
and
they're doing.
I mean, Gus and I shouldn't be laughing, but it is laughable, isn't it, to think that, you know, you're trying to test kids on things they've never been taught. I mean, maybe this is really all about whether they can keep the teachers on side, whether you've got teacher morale.
That's a good question. I mean, essentially, I mentioned earlier that I always thought this government's have headed for the Dickensian, the Dickensian sort of golden era, and they seem to be doing the same with the schools at the moment too. I thought it was a bit cheap that they just blamed Labour. I mean, everyone can always just blame the government that went before it for the problems that we're in at the moment. Though, of course, as Martin says, the academies and also the introduction of tuition fees at university, which Labour brought in, aren't exactly policies that I agree with. But, you know, what we seem to be doing in this country is measuring ability rather than aptitude, rather than people's, ability later on to grasp and learn things. We're actually just, seeing how well they can rote memorize things.
Okay.
And that categorizes people at a very early age.
Fine.
And tying in very quickly with the institutional racism, which you mentioned early, the sooner you put people into categories, the sooner you're going to hinder them in later life.
Okay, finally, Australian university sparks anger by telling students the country was invaded, not settled. Just really quickly, Martin?
Well, I mean, the history is constantly being reinterpreted. So if you're an Aborigine, the country was invaded.
Was Australia invaded by Britain or settled?
Well, I believe they all went in heavily armed and claimed land for themselves, so I think you can make your own conclusions on that one. That would be up for the history students to decide.
The Australians...
Personally, I'd argue that, yes, they were invaded by the British.
The Australians seem to be getting increasingly peeved with their old colonial masters, which seems to be actually quite sensible of them. Anyway, time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. Thanks to our guest, former Cabinet member, Green Councillor for Ashley Ward, Gus Hoyt. After the news, the Brussels attacks. Are they the United States of Europe's 9/11?
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.